exorbitant bonus on renewing it, and to give a mortgage on his pigs and horses and even his milk cow. His creditor was Wick Cutter, the merciless Black Hawk moneylender, a man of evil name throughout the county, of whom I shall have more to say later. Peter could give no very clear account of his transactions with Cutter. He only knew that he had first borrowed $200, then another $100, then $50, that each time a bonus was added to the principal, and the debt grew faster than any crop he planted. Now everything was plastered with mortgages. Soon after Peter renewed his note, Pavel strained himself lifting timbers for a new barn and fell over among the shavings with such a gush of blood from the lungs that his fellow workmen thought he would die on the spot. They hauled him home and put him into his bed, and there he lay, very ill indeed. Misfortune seemed to settle like an evil bird on the roof of the log house and to flap its wings there, warning human beings away. The Russians had such bad luck that people were afraid of them and liked to put them out of mind. One afternoon, Antonia and her father came over to our house to get buttermilk and lingered, as they usually did, until the sun was low. Just as they were leaving, Russian Peter drove up. Pavel was very bad, he said, and wanted to talk to Mr. Shimerda and his daughter. He had come to fetch them. When Antonia and her father got into the wagon, I entreated Grandmother to let me go with them. I would gladly go without my supper. I would sleep in the Shimerda's barn and run home in the morning. My plan must have seemed very foolish to her, but she was often large-minded about humoring the desires of other people. She asked Peter to wait a moment, and when she came back from the kitchen, she brought a bag of sandwiches and doughnuts for us. Mr. Shimerda and Peter were on the front seat. Antonia and I sat in the straw behind and ate our lunch as we bumped along. After the sun sank, a cold wind sprang up and moaned over the prairie. If this turn in the weather had come sooner, I should not have got away. We burrowed down in the straw and curled up close together, watching the angry red die out of the west and the stars begin to shine in the clear, windy sky. Peter kept sighing and groaning. Tony whispered to me that he was afraid Pavel would never get well. We lay still and did not talk. Up there the stars grew magnificently bright. Though we had come from such different parts of the world, in both of us there was some dusky superstition that those shining groups have their influence upon what is and what is not to be. Perhaps Russian Peter, come from farther away than any of us, had brought from his land too some such belief. The little house on the hillside was so much the color of the night that we could not see it as we came up the draw. The ruddy windows guided us, the light from the kitchen stove, for there was no lamp burning. We entered softly. The man in the wide bed seemed to be asleep. Tony and I sat down on the bench by the wall and leaned our arms on the table in front of us. The firelight flickered on the hewn logs that supported the thatch overhead. Pavel made a rasping sound when he breathed, and he kept moaning. We waited. The wind shook the doors and windows impatiently, then swept on again, singing through the big spaces. Each gust, as it bore down, rattled the panes and swelled off like the others. They made me think of defeated armies retreating, or of ghosts who were trying desperately to get in for shelter and then went moaning on. Presently, in one of those sobbing intervals between the blasts, the coyotes tuned up with their whining howl, 1, 2, 3, then all together, to tell us that winter was coming. The sound brought an answer from the bed, a long complaining cry, as if Pavel were having bad dreams or were waking to some old misery. Peter listened, but did not stir. He was sitting on the floor by the kitchen stove. The coyotes broke out again, yap, 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 then the high whine. Pavel called for something and struggled up on his elbow.
"He is scared of the wolves," Antonia whispered to me. "In his country there are very many, and they eat men and women."
We slid closer together along the bench.
I could not take my eyes off the man in the bed.
His shirt was hanging open, and his emaciated chest, covered with yellow bristle, rose and fell horribly. He began to cough. Peter shuffled to his feet, caught up the tea kettle, and mixed him some hot water and whiskey. The sharp smell of spirits went through the room. Pavel snatched the cup and drank, then made Peter give him the bottle and slipped it under his pillow, grinning disagreeably as if he had outwitted someone. His eyes followed Peter about the room with a contemptuous, unfriendly expression. It seemed to me that he despised him for being so simple and docile. Presently, Pavel began to talk to Mr. Shimerda, scarcely above a whisper. He was telling a long story, and as he went on, Antonia took my hand under the table and held it tight. She leaned forward and strained her ears to hear him. He grew more and more excited and kept pointing all around his bed as if there were things there and he wanted Mr. Shimerda to see them.
"It's wolves, Jimmy," Antonia whispered. "It's awful what he says."
The sick man raged and shook his fist. He seemed to be cursing people who had wronged him. Mr. Shimerda caught him by the shoulders but could hardly hold him in bed. At last he was shut off by a coughing fit which fairly choked him. He pulled a cloth from under his pillow and held it to his mouth. Quickly it was covered with bright red spots. I thought I had never seen any blood so bright. When he lay down and turned his face to the wall, all the rage had gone out of him. He lay patiently fighting for breath like a child with the croup. Antonia's father uncovered one of his long bony legs and rubbed it rhythmically. From our bench, we could see what a hollow case his body was. His spine and shoulder blade stood out like the bones under the hide of a dead steer left in the fields. That sharp backbone must have hurt him when he lay on it. Gradually, relief came to all of us. Whatever it was, the worst was over. Mr. Shimerda signed to us that Pavel was asleep. Without a word, Peter got up and lit his lantern. He was going out to get his team to drive us home. Mr. Shimerda went with him. We sat and watched the long bowed back under the blue sheet, scarcely daring to breathe. On the way home, when we were lying in the straw under the jolting and rattling, Antonia told me as much of the story as she could. What she did not tell me then, she told later. We talked of nothing else for days afterward. When Pavel and Peter were young men living at home in Russia, they were asked to be groomsmen for a friend who was to marry the belle of another village. It was in the dead of winter, and the groom's party went over to the wedding in sledges. Peter and Pavel drove in the groom's sledge, and six sledges followed with all his relatives and friends. After the ceremony at the church, the party went to a dinner given by the parents of the bride. The dinner lasted all afternoon. Then it became a supper and continued far into the night. There was much dancing and drinking. At midnight, the parents of the bride said goodbye to her and blessed her. The groom took her in his arms and carried her out to his sledge and tucked her under the blankets. He sprang in beside her, and Pavel and Peter, our Pavel and Peter, took the front seat. Pavel drove. The party set out with singing and the jingle of sleigh bells, the groom's sledge going first. All the drivers were more or less the worse for merrymaking, and the groom was absorbed in his bride. The wolves were bad that winter, and everyone knew it. Yet when they heard the first wolf cry, the drivers were not much alarmed. They had had too much good food and drink inside them. The first howls were taken up and echoed, and with quickening repetitions. The wolves were coming together. There was no moon, but the starlight was clear on the snow. A black drove came up over the hill behind the wedding party. The wolves ran like streaks of shadow. They looked no bigger than dogs, but there were hundreds of them. Something happened to the hindmost sledge. The driver lost control. He was probably very drunk. The horses left the road. The sledge was caught in a clump of trees and overturned. The occupants rolled out over the snow, and the fleetest of the wolves sprang upon them. The shrieks that followed made everybody sober. The drivers stood up and lashed their horses. The groom had the best team, and his sledge was lightest. All the others carried from 6 to 12 people. Another driver lost control. The screams of the horses were more terrible to hear than the cries of the men and women. Nothing seemed to check the wolves. It was hard to tell what was happening in the rear. The people who were falling behind shrieked as piteously as those who were already lost. The little bride hid her face on the groom's shoulder and sobbed. Pavel sat still and watched his horses. The road was clear and white, and the groom's three blacks went like the wind. It was only necessary to be calm and to guide them carefully. At length, as they breasted a long hill, Peter rose cautiously and looked back. "There are only 3 sledges left," he whispered.
"And the wolves?" Pavel asked.
"Enough! Enough for all of us!"
Pavel reached the brow of the hill, but only 2 sledges followed him down the other side. In that moment on the hilltop, they saw behind them a whirling black group on the snow. Presently, the groom screamed. He saw his father's sledge overturned with his mother and sisters. He sprang up as if he meant to jump, but the girl shrieked and held him back. It was even then too late. The black ground shadows were already crowding over the heap in the road, and one horse ran out across the fields, his harness hanging to him, wolves at his heels. But the groom's movement had given Pavel an idea. They were within a few miles of their village now. The only sledge left out of six was not far behind them, and Pavel's middle horse was failing. Beside a frozen pond, something happened to the other sledge. Peter saw it plainly. Three big wolves got abreast of the horses, and the horses went crazy. They tried to jump over each other, got tangled up in the harness, and overturned the sledge. When the shrieking behind them died away, Pavel realized that he was alone upon the familiar road.
"They still come?" he asked Peter.
"Yes."
"How many?"
20, 30, enough!"
Now his middle horse was being almost dragged by the other two. Pavel gave Peter the reins and stepped carefully into the back of the sledge. He called to the groom that they must lighten, and pointed to the bride. The young man cursed him and held her tighter. Pavel tried to drag her away. In the struggle, the groom rose. Pavel knocked him over the side of the sledge and threw the girl after him. He said he never remembered exactly how he did it or what happened afterward. Peter, crouching in the front seat, saw nothing. The first thing either of them noticed was a new sound that broke into the clear air, louder than they had ever heard it before, the bell of the monastery of their own village, ringing for early prayers. Pavel and Peter drove into the village alone, and they had been alone ever since. They were run out of their village. Pavel's own mother would not look at him. They went away to strange towns, but when people learned where they came from, they were always asked if they knew the two men who had fed the bride to the wolves. Wherever they went, the story followed them. It took them 5 years to save money enough to come to America. They worked in Chicago, Des Moines, Fort Wayne, but they were always unfortunate. When Pavel's health grew so bad, they decided to try farming. Pavel died a few days after he unburdened his mind to Mr. Shimerda and was buried in the Norwegian graveyard. Peter sold off everything and left the country, went to be cook in a railway construction camp where gangs of Russians were employed. At his sale, we bought Peter's wheelbarrow and some of his harness. During the auction, he went about with his head down and never lifted his eyes. He seemed not to care about anything. The Black Hawk moneylender who held mortgages on Peter's livestock was there, and he bought in the sale notes at about 50 cents on the dollar. Everyone said Peter kissed the cow before she was led away by her new owner. I did not see him do it, but this I know. After all his furniture and his cook stove and pots and pans had been hauled off by the purchasers, when his house was stripped and bare, he sat down on the floor with his clasp knife and ate all the melons that he had put away for winter. When Mr. Shimerda and Krayek drove up in their wagon to take Peter to the train, they found him with a dripping beard, surrounded by heaps of melon rinds. The loss of his two friends had a depressing effect upon old Mr. Shimerda. When he was out hunting, he used to go into the empty log house and sit there, brooding. This cabin was his hermitage until the winter snows penned him in his cave. For Antonia and me, the story of the wedding party was never at an end. We did not tell Pavel's secret to anyone, but guarded it jealously, as if the wolves of the Ukraine had gathered that night long ago and the wedding party been sacrificed to give us a painful and peculiar pleasure. At night, before I went to sleep, I often found myself in a sledge drawn by three horses, dashing through a country that looked something like Nebraska and something like Virginia. Chapter 9. The first snowfall came early in December. I remember how the world looked from our sitting room window as I dressed behind the stove that morning. The low sky was like a sheet of metal. The blonde cornfields had faded out into ghostliness at last. The little pond was frozen under its stiff willow bushes. Big white flakes were whirling over everything and disappearing in the red grass. Beyond the pond, on the slope that climbed to the cornfield, there was, faintly marked in the grass, a great circle where the Indians used to ride. Jake and Otto were sure that when they galloped around that ring, the Indians tortured prisoners, bound to a stake in the center. But Grandfather thought they merely ran races or trained horses there. Whenever one looked at this slope against the setting sun, the circle showed like a pattern in the grass. And this morning, when the first light spray of snow lay over it, it came out with wonderful distinctness, like strokes of Chinese, white on canvas. The old figure stirred me as it had never done before and seemed a good omen for the winter. As soon as the snow had packed hard, I began to drive about the country in a clumsy sleigh that Otto Fuchs made for me by fastening a wooden goods box on Bob's. Fuchs had been apprenticed to a cabinet maker in the old country and was very handy with tools. He would have done a better job if I hadn't hurried him. My first trip was to the post office, and the next day I went over to take Yulka and Antonia for a sleigh ride. It was a bright, cold day. I piled straw and buffalo robes into the box and took two hot bricks wrapped in old blankets. When I got to the Schimmertes, I did not go up to the house, but sat in my sleigh at the bottom of the draw and called. Antonia and Yulka came running out, wearing little rabbit-skin hats their father had made for them. They had heard about my sledge from Ambrosch and knew why I had come. They tumbled in beside me, and we set off toward the north, along a road that happened to be broken. The sky was brilliantly blue, and the sunlight on the glittering white stretches of prairie was almost blinding. As Antonia said, the whole world was changed by the snow. We kept looking in vain for familiar landmarks. The deep arroyo through which Squaw Creek wound was now only a cleft between snowdrifts, very blue when one looked down into it. The treetops that had been gold all the autumn were dwarfed and twisted as if they would never have any life in them again. The few little cedars, which were so dull and dingy before, now stood out a strong, dusky green. The wind had the burning taste of fresh snow. My throat and nostrils smarted as if someone had opened a hartshorn bottle. The cold stung, and at the same time delighted one. My horse's breath rose like steam, and whenever we stopped, he smoked all over. The cornfields got back a little of their color under the dazzling light, and stood the palest possible gold in the sun and snow. All about us the snow was crusted in shallow terraces, with traces like ripple marks at the edges, curly waves that were the actual impression of the stinging lash in the wind. The girls had on cotton dresses under their shawls. They kept shivering beneath the buffalo robes and hugging each other for warmth. But they were so glad to get away from their ugly cave and their mother's scolding that they begged me to go on and on, as far as Russian Peter's house. The great fresh open, after the stupefying warmth indoors, made them behave like wild things. They laughed and shouted and said they never wanted to go home again. "Couldn't we settle down and live in Russian Peter's house?" Yulka asked. "And couldn't I go to town and buy things for us to keep house with?" All the way to Russian Peter's we were extravagantly happy. But when we turned back, it must have been about 4 o'clock, the east wind grew stronger and began to howl. The sun lost its heartening power and the sky became gray and somber. I took off my long woolen comforter and wound it around Yulka's throat. She got so cold that we made her hide her head under the buffalo robe. Antonia and I sat erect, but I held the reins clumsily, and my eyes were blinded by the wind a good deal of the time. It was growing dark when we got to their house, but I refused to go in with them and get warm. I knew my hands would ache terribly if I went near a fire. Yulka forgot to give me back my comforter, and I had to drive home directly against the wind. The next day I came down with an attack of quinsy, which kept me in the house for nearly 2 weeks. The basement kitchen seemed heavenly safe and warm in those days, like a tight little boat in a winter sea. The men were out in the fields all day, husking corn, and when they came in at noon, with long caps pulled down over their ears and their feet in red-lined overshoes, I used to think they were like Arctic explorers. In the afternoons, when Grandmother sat upstairs darning or making husking gloves, I read The Swiss Family Robinson aloud to her, and I felt that the Swiss family had no advantages over us in the way of an adventurous life. I was convinced that man's strongest antagonist is the cold. I admired the cheerful zest with which Grandmother went about keeping us warm and comfortable and well-fed. She often reminded me, when she was preparing for the return of the hungry men, that this country was not like Virginia, and that here a cook had, as she said, very little to do with. On Sundays, she gave us as much chicken as we could eat, and on other days we had ham or bacon or sausage meat. She baked either pies or cake for us every day, unless, for a change, she made my favorite pudding, striped with currants and boiled in a bag. Next to getting warm and keeping warm, dinner and supper were the most interesting things we had to think about. Our lives centered around warmth and food and the return of the men at nightfall. I used to wonder, when they came in tired from the fields, their feet numb and their hands cracked and sore, how they could do all the chores so conscientiously. Feed and water and bed the horses, milk the cows, and look after the pigs. When supper was over, it took them a long while to get the cold out of their bones. While Grandmother and I washed the dishes and Grandfather read his paper upstairs, Jake and Otto sat on the long bench behind the stove, easing their inside boots or rubbing mutton tallow into their cracked hands. Every Saturday night we popped corn or made taffy, and Otto Fuchs used to sing, "For I am a cowboy and know I've done wrong," or "Bury me not on the lone prairie." He had a good baritone voice and always led the singing when we went to church services at the sod schoolhouse. I can still see those two men sitting on the bench, Otto's close-clipped head and Jake's shaggy hair slicked flat in front by a wet comb. I can see the sag of their tired shoulders against the whitewashed wall. What good fellows they were, how much they knew, and how many things they had kept faith with. Fuchs had been a cowboy, a stage driver, a bartender, a miner, had wandered all over that great western country and done hard work everywhere, though, as Grandmother said, he had nothing to show for it. Jake was duller than Otto. He could scarcely read, wrote even his name with difficulty, and he had a violent temper which sometimes made him behave like a crazy man, tore him all to pieces and actually made him ill. But he was so soft-hearted that anyone could impose upon him. If he, as he said, forgot himself and swore before Grandmother, he went about depressed and shamefaced all day. They were both of them jovial about the cold in winter and the heat in summer, always ready to work overtime and to meet emergencies. It was a matter of pride with them not to spare themselves. Yet they were the sort of men who never get on, somehow, or do anything but work hard for a dollar or two a day. On those bitter, starlit nights, as we sat around the old stove that fed us and warmed us and kept us cheerful, we could hear the coyotes howling down by the corrals, and their hungry, wintry cry used to remind the boys of wonderful animal stories, about gray wolves and bears in the Rockies, wildcats and panthers in the Virginia mountains. Sometimes Fuchs could be persuaded to talk about the outlaws and desperate characters he had known. I remember one funny story about himself that made Grandmother, who was working her bread on the breadboard, laugh until she wiped her eyes with her bare arm, her hands being floury. It was like this. When Otto left Austria to come to America, he was asked by one of his relatives to look after a woman who was crossing on the same boat to join her husband in Chicago. The woman started off with two children, but it was clear that her family might grow larger on the journey. Fuchs said he got on fine with the kids and liked the mother, though she played a sorry trick on him. In mid-ocean, she proceeded to have not one baby, but three. This event made Fuchs the object of undeserved notoriety, since he was traveling with her. The steerage stewardess was indignant with him. The doctor regarded him with suspicion. The first cabin passengers who made up a purse for the woman took an embarrassing interest in Otto and often inquired of him about his charge. When the triplets were taken ashore at New York, he had, as he said, to carry some of them. The trip to Chicago was even worse than the ocean voyage. On the train, it was very difficult to get milk for the babies and to keep their bottles clean. The mother did her best, but no woman, out of her natural resources, could feed three babies. The husband, in Chicago, was working in a furniture factory for modest wages, and when he met his family at the station, he was rather crushed by the size of it. He, too, seemed to consider Fuchs in some fashion to blame. "I was sure glad," Otto concluded, "that he didn't take his hard feeling out on that poor woman. But he had a sullen eye for me, all right. Now, did you ever hear of a young feller's having such hard luck, Mrs. Burden?" Grandmother told him she was sure the Lord had remembered these things to his credit and had helped him out of many a scrape when he didn't realize that he was being protected by Providence. Chapter 10. For several weeks after my sleigh ride, we heard nothing from the Schemerders. My sore throat kept me indoors, and grandmother had a cold which made the housework heavy for her. When Sunday came, she was glad to have a day of rest. One night at supper, Fuchs told us he had seen Mr. Schemerda out hunting. "He's made himself a rabbit-skin cap, Jim, and a rabbit-skin collar that he buttons on outside his coat. They ain't got but one overcoat among 'em over there, and they take turns wearing it. They seem awful scared of cold, and stick in that hole in the bank like badgers." "All but the crazy boy," Jake put in. "He never wears the coat. Craig says he's terrible strong and can stand anything. I guess rabbits must be getting scarce in this locality. Ambrose came along by the cornfield yesterday where I was at work and showed me 3 prairie dogs he'd shot. He asked me if they was good to eat. I spit and made a face and took on to scare him, but he just looked like he was smarter than me and put 'em back in his sack and walked off." Grandmother looked up in alarm and spoke to Grandfather. "Josiah, you don't suppose Kryak would let them poor creatures eat prairie dogs, do you?"
"You had better go over and see our neighbors tomorrow, Emmeline," he replied gravely.
Fuchs put in a cheerful word and said prairie dogs were clean beasts and ought to be good for food, but their family connections were against them. I asked what he meant, and he grinned and said they belonged to the rat family. When I went downstairs in the morning, I found Grandmother and Jake packing a hamper basket in the kitchen.
"Now, Jake," Grandmother was saying, "if you can find that old rooster that got his comb froze, just give his neck a twist and we'll take him along. There's no good reason why Mrs. Schemerda couldn't have got hens from her neighbors last fall and had a hen house going by now. I reckon she was confused and didn't know where to begin. I've come strange to a new country myself, but I never forgot hens are a good thing to have, no matter what you don't have."
"Just as you say, ma'am," said Jake. "But I hate to think of Kryak getting a leg of that old rooster." He tramped out through the long cellar and dropped the heavy door behind him. After breakfast, Grandmother and Jake and I bundled ourselves up and climbed into the cold front wagon seat. As we approached the Schemerdas, we heard the frosty whine of the pump and saw Antonia, her head tied up and her cotton dress blown about her, throwing all her weight on the pump handle as it went up and down. She heard our wagon, looked back over her shoulder, and, catching up her pail of water, started at a run for the hole in the bank. Jake helped Grandmother to the ground, saying he would bring the provisions after he had blanketed his horses. We went slowly up the icy path toward the door sunk in the draw side. Blue puffs of smoke came from the stovepipe that stuck out through the grass and snow, but the wind whisked them roughly away. Mrs. Schemerda opened the door before we knocked and seized Grandmother's hand. She did not say, "How do," as usual, but at once began to cry. Talking very fast in her own language, pointing to her feet which were tied up in rags, and looking about accusingly at everyone. The old man was sitting on a stump behind the stove, crouching over as if he were trying to hide from us. Yulka was on the floor at his feet, her kitten in her lap. She peeped out at me and smiled, but, glancing up at her mother, hid again. Antonia was washing pans and dishes in a dark corner. The crazy boy lay under the only window, stretched on a gunny sack stuffed with straw. As soon as we entered, he threw a grain sack over the crack at the bottom of the door. The air in the cave was stifling, and it was very dark, too. A lighted lantern, hung over the stove, threw out a feeble yellow glimmer. Mrs. Schemerda snatched off the covers of 2 barrels behind the door and made us look into them. In one there were some potatoes that had been frozen and were rotting. In the other was a little pile of flour. Grandmother murmured something in embarrassment, but the Bohemian woman laughed scornfully, a kind of whinny laugh, and, catching up an empty coffee pot from the shelf, shook it at us with a look positively vindictive. Grandmother went on talking in her polite Virginia way, not admitting their stark need or her own remissness, until Jake arrived with the hamper, as if in direct answer to Mrs. Schemerda's reproaches. Then the poor woman broke down. She dropped on the floor beside her crazy son, hid her face on her knees, and sat crying bitterly. Grandmother paid no heed to her, but called Antonia to come and help empty the basket. Tony left her corner reluctantly. I had never seen her crushed like this before.
"You not mind my poor mamenka, Mrs. Burden. She is so sad," she whispered, as she wiped her wet hands on her skirt and took the things Grandmother handed her.
The crazy boy, seeing the food, began to make soft, gurgling noises and stroked his stomach. Jake came in again, this time with a sack of potatoes.
Grandmother looked about in perplexity.
"Haven't you got any sort of cave or cellar outside, Antonia? This is no place to keep vegetables. How did your potatoes get frozen?"
"We get from Mr. Bushy at the post office what he throw out. We got no potatoes, Mrs. Burden," Tony admitted mournfully.
When Jake went out, Merrick crawled along the floor and stuffed up the door crack again. Then, quietly as a shadow, Mr. Shemurda came out from behind the stove. He stood brushing his hand over his smooth gray hair as if he were trying to clear away a fog about his head. He was clean and neat as usual, with his green neckcloth and his coral pin. He took Grandmother's arm and led her behind the stove to the back of the room. In the rear wall was another little cave, a round hole, not much bigger than an oil barrel, scooped out in the black earth. When I got up on one of the stools and peered into it, I saw some quilts and a pile of straw. The old man held the lantern.
"Yulka," he said in a low, despairing voice.
"Yulka, my Antonia."
Grandmother drew back.
"You mean they sleep in there? Your girls?"
He bowed his head.
Tony slipped under his arm.
"It is very cold on the floor, and this is warm like the badger hole. I like for sleep there," she insisted eagerly. "My mamenka have nice bed with pillows from our own geese in Bohemi. See, Jim?"
She pointed to the narrow bunk which Kryak had built against the wall for himself before the Shemurdas came. Grandmother sighed.
"Sure enough, where would you sleep, dear? I don't doubt you're warm there. You'll have a better house after a while, Antonia, and then you will forget these hard times."
Mr. Shemurda made Grandmother sit down on the only chair and pointed his wife to a stool beside her. Standing before them with his hand on Antonia's shoulder, he talked in a low tone, and his daughter translated. He wanted us to know that they were not beggars in the old country. He made good wages, and his family were respected there. He left Bohemia with more than $1,000 in savings after their passage money was paid. He had in some way lost on exchange in New York, and the railway fare to Nebraska was more than they had expected. By the time they paid Kryak for the land and bought his horses and oxen and some old farm machinery, they had very little money left. He wished Grandmother to know, however, that he still had some money. If they could get through until spring came, they would buy a cow and chickens and plant a garden, and would then do very well. Ambrose and Antonia were both old enough to work in the fields, and they were willing to work. But the snow and the bitter weather had disheartened them all. Antonia explained that her father meant to build a new house for them in the spring. He and Ambrose had already split the logs for it, but the logs were all buried in the snow along the creek where they had been felled. While Grandmother encouraged and gave them advice, I sat down on the floor with Yulka and let her show me her kitten. Merrick slid cautiously toward us and began to exhibit his webbed fingers. I knew he wanted to make his queer noises for me, to bark like a dog or whinny like a horse, but he did not dare in the presence of his elders. Merrick was always trying to be agreeable, poor fellow, as if he had it on his mind that he must make up for his deficiencies. Mrs. Shemurda grew more calm and reasonable before our visit was over, and, while Antonia translated, put in a word now and then on her own account. The woman had a quick ear and caught up phrases whenever she heard English spoken. As we rose to go, she opened her wooden chest and brought out a bag made of bed ticking about as long as a flour sack and half as wide, stuffed full of something. At sight of it, the crazy boy began to smack his lips. When Mrs. Shemurda opened the bag and stirred the contents with her hand, it gave out a salty, earthy smell, very pungent, even among the other odors of that cave. She measured a teacup full, tied it up in a bit of sacking, and presented it ceremoniously to Grandmother.
"For cook," she announced. "Little now, be very much when cook,"
spreading out her hands as if to indicate that the pint would swell to a gallon.
"Very good. You no have in this country. All things for eat better in my country."
"Maybe so, Mrs. Shemurda," Grandmother said dryly. "I can't say, but I prefer our bread to yours myself."
Antonia undertook to explain.
"This very good, Mrs. Burden."
She clasped her hands as if she could not express how good.
"It make very much when you cook, like what my mama say. Cook with rabbit, cook with chicken, in the gravy, oh, so good."
All the way home, Grandmother and Jake talked about how easily good Christian people could forget that they were their brother's keepers. I will say, Jake, some of our brothers and sisters are hard to keep. Where's a body to begin with these people? They're wanting in everything, and most of all in horse sense. Nobody can give them that, I guess. Jimmy here is about as able to take over a homestead as they are. Do you reckon that boy Ambrose has any real push in him? Well, he's a worker all right, ma'am, and he's got some catch-on about him, but he's a mean one. Folks can be mean enough to get on in this world, and then again they can be too mean. That night, while Grandmother was getting supper, we opened the package Mrs. Shimerda had given her. It was full of little brown chips that looked like the shavings of some root. They were as light as feathers, and the most noticeable thing about them was their penetrating, earthy odor. We could not determine whether they were animal or vegetable. "They might be dried meat from some queer beast, Jim. They ain't dried fish, and they never grew on stalk or vine. I'm afraid of them. Anyhow, I shouldn't want to eat anything that had been shut up for months with old clothes and goose pillows." She threw the package into the stove, but I bit off a corner of one of the chips I held in my hand and chewed it tentatively. I never forgot the strange taste, though it was many years before I knew that those little brown shavings, which the Shimerders had brought so far and treasured so jealously, were dried mushrooms. They had been gathered, probably, in some deep Bohemian forest. Chapter 11. During the week before Christmas, Jake was the most important person of our household, for he was to go to town and do all our Christmas shopping. But on the 21st of December, the snow began to fall. The flakes came down so thickly that from the sitting room windows I could not see beyond the windmill. Its frame looked dim and gray, unsubstantial, like a shadow. The snow did not stop falling all day or during the night that followed. The cold was not severe, but the storm was quiet and resistless. The men could not go farther than the barns and corral. They sat about the house most of the day as if it were Sunday, greasing their boots, mending their suspenders, plaiting whiplashes. On the morning of the 22nd, Grandfather announced at breakfast that it would be impossible to go to Black Hawk for Christmas purchases. Jake was sure he could get through on horseback and bring home our things in saddlebags, but Grandfather told him the roads would be obliterated, and a newcomer in the country would be lost 10 times over. Anyway, he would never allow one of his horses to be put to such a strain. We decided to have a country Christmas, without any help from town. I had wanted to get some picture books for Yulka and Antonia. Even Yulka was able to read a little now. Grandmother took me into the ice-cold storeroom, where she had some bolts of gingham and sheeting. She cut squares of cotton cloth, and we sewed them together into a book. We bound it between pasteboards, which I covered with brilliant calico, representing scenes from a circus. For 2 days I sat at the dining room table, pasting this book full of pictures for Yulka. We had files of those good old family magazines which used to publish colored lithographs of popular paintings, and I was allowed to use some of these. I took Napoleon Announcing the Divorce to Josephine for my frontispiece. On the white pages I grouped Sunday school cards and advertising cards which I had brought from my old country. Fuchs got out the old candle molds and made tallow candles. Grandmother hunted up her fancy cake cutters and baked gingerbread men and roosters, which we decorated with burnt sugar and red cinnamon drops. On the day before Christmas, Jake packed the things we were sending to the Shimerdas in his saddlebags and set off on Grandfather's gray gelding. When he mounted his horse at the door, I saw that he had a hatchet slung to his belt, and he gave Grandmother a meaning look which told me he was planning a surprise for me. That afternoon I watched long and eagerly from the sitting room window. At last I saw a dark spot moving on the west hill, beside the half-buried cornfield, where the sky was taking on a coppery flush from the sun that did not quite break through. I put on my cap and ran out to meet Jake. When I got to the pond, I could see that he was bringing in a little cedar tree across his pommel. He used to help my father cut Christmas trees for me in Virginia, and he had not forgotten how much I liked them. By the time we had placed the cold, fresh-smelling little tree in a corner of the sitting room, it was already Christmas Eve. After supper we all gathered there, and even Grandfather, reading his paper by the table, looked up with friendly interest now and then. The cedar was about 5 feet high and very shapely. We hung it with the gingerbread animals, strings of popcorn, and bits of candle which Fuchs had fitted into pasteboard sockets.
Its real splendors, however, came from the most unlikely place in the world, from Otto's cowboy trunk. I had never seen anything in that trunk but old boots and spurs and pistols and a fascinating mixture of yellow leather thongs, cartridges, and shoemaker's wax. From under the lining, he now produced a collection of brilliantly colored paper figures, several inches high and stiff enough to stand alone. They had been sent to him year after year by his old mother in Austria. There was a bleeding heart in tufts of paper lace. There were the three kings, gorgeously apparelled, and the ox and the ass and the shepherds. There was the baby in the manger and a group of angels singing. There were camels and leopards held by the black slaves of the three kings. Our tree became the talking tree of the fairy tale. Legends and stories nestled like birds in its branches. Grandmother said it reminded her of the tree of knowledge. We put sheets of cotton wool under it for a snowfield and Jake's pocket mirror for a frozen lake. I can see them now, exactly as they looked, working about the table in the lamplight. Jake with his heavy features, so rudely molded that his face seemed somehow unfinished. Otto with his half ear and the savage scar that made his upper lip curl so ferociously under his twisted mustache. As I remember them, what unprotected faces they were. Their very roughness and violence made them defenseless. These boys had no practiced manner behind which they could retreat and hold people at a distance. They had only their hard fists to batter at the world with. Otto was already one of those drifting, case-hardened laborers who never marry or have children of their own. Yet he was so fond of children. Chapter 12. On Christmas morning, when I got down to the kitchen, the men were just coming in from their morning chores. The horses and pigs always had their breakfast before we did. Jake and Otto shouted "Merry Christmas" to me and winked at each other when they saw the waffle irons on the stove. Grandfather came down wearing a white shirt and his Sunday coat. Morning prayers were longer than usual. He read the chapters from St. Matthew about the birth of Christ, and as we listened, it all seemed like something that had happened lately and near at hand. In his prayer, he thanked the Lord for the first Christmas and for all that it had meant to the world ever since. He gave thanks for our food and comfort and prayed for the poor and destitute in great cities, where the struggle for life was harder than it was here with us. Grandfather's prayers were often very interesting. He had the gift of simple and moving expression. Because he talked so little, his words had a peculiar force. They were not worn dull from constant use. His prayers reflected what he was thinking about at the time, and it was chiefly through them that we got to know his feelings and his views about things. After we sat down to our waffles and sausage, Jake told us how pleased the Shimerdas had been with their presents. Even Ambrose was friendly and went to the creek with him to cut the Christmas tree. It was a soft gray day outside, with heavy clouds working across the sky and occasional squalls of snow. There were always odd jobs to be done about the barn on holidays, and the men were busy until afternoon. Then Jake and I played dominoes while Otto wrote a long letter home to his mother. He always wrote to her on Christmas Day, he said, no matter where he was and no matter how long it had been since his last letter. All afternoon he sat in the dining room. He would write for a while, then sit idle, his clenched fist lying on the table, his eyes following the pattern of the oilcloth. He spoke and wrote his own language so seldom that it came to him awkwardly. His effort to remember entirely absorbed him. At about 4 o'clock, a visitor appeared. Mr. Shimerda, wearing his rabbitskin cap and collar and new mittens his wife had knitted. He had come to thank us for the presents and for all Grandmother's kindness to his family. Jake and Otto joined us from the basement and we sat about the stove, enjoying the deepening gray of the winter afternoon and the atmosphere of comfort and security in my grandfather's house. This feeling seemed completely to take possession of Mr. Shimerda. I suppose, in the crowded clutter of their cave, the old man had come to believe that peace and order had vanished from the earth, or existed only in the old world he had left so far behind. He sat still and passive, his head resting against the back of the wooden rocking chair, his hands relaxed upon the arms. His face had a look of weariness and pleasure, like that of sick people when they feel relief from pain. Grandmother insisted on his drinking a glass of Virginia apple brandy after his long walk in the cold, and when a faint flush came up in his cheeks, his features might have been cut out of a shell, they were so transparent. He said almost nothing, and smiled rarely. But as he rested there, we all had a sense of his utter content. As it grew dark, I asked whether I might light the Christmas tree before the lamp was brought. When the candle ends sent up their conical yellow flames, all the colored figures from Austria stood out clear and full of meaning against the green boughs. Mr. Schemert arose, crossed himself, and quietly knelt down before the tree, his head sunk forward. His long body formed a letter S. I saw Grandmother look apprehensively at Grandfather. He was rather narrow in religious matters and sometimes spoke out and hurt people's feelings. There had been nothing strange about the tree before, but now, with someone kneeling before it, images, candles, Grandfather merely put his fingertips to his brow and bowed his venerable head, thus Protestantizing the atmosphere. We persuaded our guest to stay for supper with us. He needed little urging. As we sat down to the table, it occurred to me that he liked to look at us, and that our faces were open books to him. When his deep-seeing eyes rested on me, I felt as if he were looking far ahead into the future for me, down the road I would have to travel. At 9 o'clock, Mr. Schemert lighted one of our lanterns and put on his overcoat and fur collar. He stood in the little entry hall, the lantern and his fur cap under his arm, shaking hands with us. When he took Grandmother's hand, he bent over it as he always did, and said slowly, "Good woman." He made the sign of the cross over me, put on his cap, and went off in the dark. As we turned back to the sitting room, Grandfather looked at me searchingly. "The prayers of all good people are good," he said quietly. Chapter 13. The week following Christmas brought in a thaw, and by New Year's Day all the world about us was a broth of gray slush, and the guttered slope between the windmill and the barn was running black water. The soft black earth stood out in patches along the roadsides. I resumed all my chores, carried in the cobs and wood and water, and spent the afternoons at the barn watching Jake shell corn with a hand sheller. One morning, during this interval of fine weather, Antonia and her mother rode over on one of their shaggy old horses to pay us a visit. It was the first time Mrs. Schemerda had been to our house, and she ran about examining our carpets and curtains and furniture, all the while commenting upon them to her daughter in an envious, complaining tone. In the kitchen, she caught up an iron pot that stood on the back of the stove and said, "You got many. Schemerda's no got." I thought it weak-minded of Grandmother to give the pot to her. After dinner, when she was helping to wash the dishes, she said, tossing her head, "You got many things for cook. If I got old things like you, I make much better." She was a conceited, boastful old thing, and even misfortune could not humble her. I was so annoyed that I felt coldly even toward Antonia, and listened unsympathetically when she told me her father was not well.
"My papa sad for the old country. He not look good. He never make music any more. At home, he play violin all the time, for weddings and for dance. Here, never.
When I beg him for play, he shake his head no. Some days he take his violin out of his box and make with his fingers on the strings, like this, but never he make the music. He don't like this country."
"People who don't like this country ought to stay at home," I said severely. "We don't make them come here."
"He not want to come? Never!" she burst out. "My mamenka make him come. All the time she say, 'America, big country, much money, much land for my boys, much husband for my girls.' My papa, he cry for leave his old friends what make music with him. He love very much the man what play the long horn like this." She indicated a slide trombone. "They go to school together and are friends from boys. But my mama, she want Ambrose for be rich, with many cattle."
"Your mama," I said angrily, "wants other people's things."
"Your grandfather is rich," she retorted fiercely. "Why he not help my papa? Ambrose be rich too after a while, and he pay back. He's very smart boy. For Ambrose, my mama come here."
Ambrose was considered the important person in the family. Mrs. Shimerda and Antonia always deferred to him, though he was often surly with them and contemptuous toward his father. Ambrose and his mother had everything their own way. Though Antonia loved her father more than she did anyone else, she stood in awe of her elder brother. After I watched Antonia and her mother go over the hill on their miserable horse, carrying our iron pot with them, I turned to Grandmother, who had taken up her darning, and said I hoped that snooping old woman wouldn't come to see us any more. Grandmother chuckled and drove her bright needle across a hole in Otto's sock.
"She's not old, Jim, though I expect she seems old to you. No, I wouldn't mourn if she never came again. But, you see, a body never knows what traits poverty might bring out in 'em. It makes a woman graspin' to see her children want for things. Now, read me a chapter in The Prince of the House of David. Let's forget the Bohemians."
We had 3 weeks of this mild, open weather. The cattle in the corral ate corn almost as fast as the men could shell it for them, and we hoped they would be ready for an early market. One morning, the two big bulls, Gladstone and Brigham Young, thought spring had come, and they began to tease and butt at each other across the barbed wire that separated them. Soon they got angry. They bellowed and pawed up the soft earth with their hoofs, rolling their eyes and tossing their heads. Each withdrew to a far corner of his own corral, and then they made for each other at a gallop. Thud! Thud! We could hear the impact of their great heads, and their bellowing shook the pans on the kitchen shelves. Had they not been dehorned, they would have torn each other to pieces. Pretty soon the fat steers took it up and began butting and horning each other. Clearly the affair had to be stopped. We all stood by and watched admiringly while Fuchs rode into the corral with a pitchfork and prodded the bulls again and again, finally driving them apart. The big storm of the winter began on my 11th birthday, the 20th of January. When I went down to breakfast that morning, Jake and Otto came in white as snowmen, beating their hands and stamping their feet. They began to laugh boisterously when they saw me, calling, "You've got a birthday present this time, Jim, and no mistake. There was a full-blown blizzard ordered for you." All day the storm went on. The snow did not fall this time. It simply spilled out of heaven, like thousands of feather beds being emptied. That afternoon the kitchen was a carpenter shop. The men brought in their tools and made two great wooden shovels with long handles. Neither Grandmother nor I could go out in the storm, so Jake fed the chickens and brought in a pitiful contribution of eggs. Next day our men had to shovel until noon to reach the barn, and the snow was still falling. There had not been such a storm in the 10 years my grandfather had lived in Nebraska. He said at dinner that we would not try to reach the cattle. They were fat enough to go without their corn for a day or two, but tomorrow we must feed them and thaw out their water taps so that they could drink. We could not so much as see the corrals, but we knew the steers were over there, huddled together under the north bank. Our ferocious bulls, subdued enough by this time, were probably warming each other's backs.
"This'll take the bile out of 'em," Fuchs remarked gleefully.
At noon that day the hens had not been heard from. After dinner, Jake and Otto, their damp clothes now dried on them, stretched their stiff arms and plunged again into the drifts. They made a tunnel through the snow to the henhouse, with walls so solid that Grandmother and I could walk back and forth in it. We found the chickens asleep. Perhaps they thought night had come to stay. One old rooster was stirring about, pecking at the solid lump of ice in their water tin. When we flashed the lantern in their eyes, the hens set up a great cackling and flew about clumsily, scattering down feathers. The mottled pin-headed guinea hens, always resentful of captivity, ran screeching out into the tunnel and tried to poke their ugly painted faces through the snow walls. By 5 o'clock the chores were done, just when it was time to begin them all over again. That was a strange, unnatural sort of day. Chapter 14. On the morning of the 22nd, I wakened with a start. Before I opened my eyes, I seemed to know that something had happened. I heard excited voices in the kitchen. Grandmother's was so shrill that I knew she must be almost beside herself. I looked forward to any new crisis with delight. What could it be, I wondered, as I hurried into my clothes. Perhaps the barn had burned. Perhaps the cattle had frozen to death. Perhaps a neighbor was lost in the storm. Down in the kitchen, Grandfather was standing before the stove with his hands behind him. Jake and Otto had taken off their boots and were rubbing their woolen socks. Their clothes and boots were steaming, and they both looked exhausted.
On the bench behind the stove lay a man, covered up with a blanket. Grandmother motioned me to the dining room. I obeyed reluctantly. I watched her as she came and went, carrying dishes. Her lips were tightly compressed, and she kept whispering to herself, "Oh, dear Savior, Lord, thou knowest." Presently, Grandfather came in and spoke to me.
"Jimmy, we will not have prayers this morning because we have a great deal to do. Old Mr. Shimerda is dead, and his family are in great distress. Ambrose came over here in the middle of the night, and Jake and Otto went back with him. The boys have had a hard night, and you must not bother them with questions. That is Ambrose asleep on the bench. Come in to breakfast, boys."
After Jake and Otto had swallowed their first cup of coffee, they began to talk excitedly, disregarding Grandmother's warning glances. I held my tongue, but I listened with all my ears.
"No, sir," Fuchs said in answer to a question from Grandfather. "Nobody heard the gun go off. Ambrose was out with the oxen, trying to break a road, and the women folks was shut up tight in their cave. When Ambrose come in, it was dark, and he didn't see nothing, but the oxen acted kind of queer. One of 'em ripped around and got away from him, bolted clean out of the stable. His hands is blistered where the rope run through. He got a lantern and went back and found the old man, just as we seen him."
"Poor soul, poor soul," Grandmother groaned. "I'd like to think he'd never done it. He was always considerate and unwishful to give trouble. How could he forget himself and bring this on us?"
"I don't think he was out of his head for a minute, Mrs. Burden," Fuchs declared. "He done everything natural. You know, he was always sort of fixy, and fixy he was to the last. He shaved after dinner, and washed hisself all over after the girls had done the dishes. Antonia heated the water for him. Then he put on a clean shirt and clean socks, and after he was dressed he kissed her and the little one, and took his gun and said he was going out to hunt rabbits. He must have gone right down to the barn and done it then. He laid down on that bunk bed, close to the ox stalls, where he always slept. When we found him, everything was decent except—" Fuchs wrinkled his brow and hesitated. "Except what he couldn't nowise foresee. His coat was hung on a peg, and his boots was under the bed. He took off that silk neckcloth he always wore, and folded it smooth, and stuck his pin through it. He turned back his shirt at the neck and rolled up his sleeves."
"I don't see how he could do it," Grandmother kept saying.
Otto misunderstood her.
"Why, ma'am, it was simple enough. He pulled the trigger with his big toe. He laid over on his side and put the end of the barrel in his mouth, then he drew up one foot and felt for the trigger. He found it all right."
"Maybe he did," said Jake grimly. "There's something mighty queer about it." "Now, what do you mean, Jake?" Grandmother asked sharply. "Well, ma'am, I found Kryak's axe under the manger, and I picks it up and carries it over to the corpse, and I take my oath it just fits the gash in the front of the old man's face. That there Kryak had been sneaking round, pale and quiet, and when he seen me examining the axe, he began whimpering. My God, man, don't do that!"
"I reckon I'm a-going to look into this," says I. Then he begun to squeal like a rat and run about wringing his hands. "They'll hang me," says he. "My God, they'll hang me, sure!"
Fuchs spoke up impatiently.
"Kryak's gone silly, Jake, and so have you. The old man wouldn't have made all them preparations for Kryak to murder him, would he? It don't hang together. The gun was right beside him when Ambrose found him."
"Kryak could have put it there, couldn't he?" Jake demanded.
Grandmother broke in excitedly.
"See here, Jake Marpole, don't you go trying to add murder to suicide. We're deep enough in trouble. I don't read you too many of them detective stories."
"It will be easy to decide all that, Emmeline," said Grandfather quietly. "If he shot himself in the way they think, the gash will be torn from the inside outward."
"Just so it is, Mr. Burden," Otto affirmed. "I seen bunches of hair and stuff sticking to the poles and straw along the roof. They was blown up there by gunshot, no question."
Grandmother told Grandfather she meant to go over to the Shimerdas with him.
"There is nothing you can do," he said doubtfully. "The body can't be touched until we get the coroner here from Black Hawk, and that will be a matter of several days this weather."
"Well, I can take them some victuals anyway, and say a word of comfort to them poor little girls. The oldest one was his darling, and was like a right hand to him. He might have thought of her. He's left her alone in a hard world."
She glanced distrustfully at Ambrose, who was now eating his breakfast at the kitchen table.
Fuchs, although he had been up in the cold nearly all night, was going to make the long ride to Black Hawk to fetch the priest and the coroner. On the Grey Gelding, our best horse, he would try to pick his way across the country with no roads to guide him.
"Don't you worry about me, Mrs. Burden," he said cheerfully as he put on a second pair of socks. "I've got a good nose for directions, and I never did need much sleep. It's the Grey I'm worried about. I'll save him what I can, but it'll strain him, as sure as I'm telling you."
"This is no time to be over-considerate of animals, Otto. Do the best you can for yourself. Stop at the Widow Stevens for dinner. She's a good woman, and she'll do well by you." After Fuchs rode away, I was left with Ambrosch. I saw a side of him I had not seen before. He was deeply, even slavishly, devout. He did not say a word all morning, but sat with his rosary in his hands, praying, now silently, now aloud. He never looked away from his beads, nor lifted his hands except to cross himself. Several times the poor boy fell asleep where he sat, wakened with a start, and began to pray again. No wagon could be got to the Schemerdes until a road was broken, and that would be a day's job. Grandfather came from the barn on one of our big black horses, and Jake lifted Grandmother up behind him. She wore her black hood and was bundled up in shawls. Grandfather tucked his bushy white beard inside his overcoat. They looked very biblical as they set off, I thought. Jake and Ambrosch followed them, riding the other black and my pony, carrying bundles of clothes that we had got together from Mrs. Schemerde. I watched them go past the pond and over the hill by the drifted cornfield. Then, for the first time, I realized that I was alone in the house. I felt a considerable extension of power and authority, and was anxious to acquit myself creditably. I carried in cobs and wood from the long cellar, and filled both the stoves. I remembered that in the hurry and excitement of the morning, nobody had thought of the chickens, and the eggs had not been gathered. Going out through the tunnel, I gave the hens their corn, emptied the ice from their drinking pan, and filled it with water. After the cat had had his milk, I could think of nothing else to do, and I sat down to get warm. The quiet was delightful, and the ticking clock was the most pleasant of companions. I got Robinson Crusoe and tried to read, but his life on the island seemed dull compared with ours. Presently, as I looked with satisfaction about our comfortable sitting room, it flashed upon me that if Mr. Schemerde's soul were lingering about in this world at all, it would be here, in our house, which had been more to his liking than any other in the neighborhood. I remembered his contented face when he was with us on Christmas Day. If he could have lived with us, this terrible thing would never have happened. I knew it was homesickness that had killed Mr. Schemerde, and I wondered whether his released spirit would not eventually find its way back to his own country. I thought of how far it was to Chicago, and then to Virginia, to Baltimore, and then the great wintry ocean. No, he would not at once set out upon that long journey. Surely his exhausted spirit